now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is a Fordian investigator and former teacher, newspaper journalist Linda S. Godfrey. Linda S. Godfrey is the author of 17 books on strange creatures, people, and places, including The Beast of Bray Road, Weird Wisconsin, Weird Michigan, Real Wolfman, True Encounters in Modern America, American Monsters, A History of Monster Lore, Legends, and Sightings in America, and her most recent book, Monsters Among Us, which explores the even stranger side of strange creature sightings. She has been a guest on national TV and radio shows, including 30 Odd Minutes, Seasons 1 and 4 of Monster Quest, Sean Hannity's America, Lost Tapes, Inside Edition, Sci-Fi's Haunted Highway, Monsters and Mysteries, America's Scariest Places, Fox News Red Eye Show, Wisconsin and Michigan Public Radio, Coast to Coast AM Radio, and many more. Also, as an artist, Godfrey illustrates many of her own books and lives in cryptid-packed southeast Wisconsin near the Kettle Moraine State Forest with her husband and dog. Visit her blog at lindagodfrey.com. And without any further ado, Linda Godfrey, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited about the show, Linda. I really feel that the listeners of the Cosmic Switchboard Show will benefit from learning about the rich diversity of life forms that we have on our planet, and the fact that reports of these cryptids, so-called, go back since time immemorial. Do you want to tell our listeners, Linda, how you got into this field?
Well, it wasn't anything that I had planned. Let me put it that way. It was just something that occurred in my life, and I made a series of choices at the time, and I'm talking like almost 26 years ago, that have impacted my life ever since. And at the time, I was actually working very hard on creating a comic strip or an editorial cartoon recurring feature that I could get nationally syndicated. That was really what I wanted to do, and I'd been working very, very hard on that. I was lucky to have a mentor in Lake Geneva here, Joe Martin, who I think holds the title of world's most prolific cartoonist. And I was on a first-name basis with a couple of the big syndicate heads that were kind of working with me. And I almost made it. I had an offer that just didn't turn out, and it was so disappointing. I thought, I'm just going to do some cartoons for free and get a bunch of publications so I can, you know, show that I'm published and show that my work has merit and that kind of thing. And we had a weekly newspaper in Walworth County called The Week. And when I say newspaper, I've seen it written about as like a shopper type of thing, you know, and it really wasn't. It was a real newspaper with editorial staff, editors, stories about all manner of things, from politics to local happenings. It was just a really nice paper, and I kind of knew one of the editors and asked him if I could just start doing these cartoons for him. And after a while, they actually started paying me $8 a week. And now, this was not the Depression. I'm not that old. Yes, it was, you know, the next step up from zero, but it was something. And so I had done that for about a year, and I was talking to the editor one day, and he said, you know, this reporter just quit. Would you like to be a reporter? And he knew I could write somewhat because of, you know, I could at least put together cartoon sentences, which are actually a harder thing to write than, there's a saying in the news business that shorter is more difficult, you know, than long. And so I had that behind me, and I guess he took a gamble on it, and I started just doing some small features, and then I heard this rumor from somebody who sometimes submitted freelance articles to the newspaper and was also a school bus driver. When you live in a small town, you often end up becoming sort of a jill or jack of all trades, because there aren't a lot of big jobs supporting you. Many people have to take, a couple of small-time jobs. And she was telling me that people around Elkhorn, including a couple of people that she knew, were seeing this creature that they said they didn't know for sure what it was, but it looked like a werewolf because it had the head of a German shepherd, was generally measured at about estimated to be 5.5 to 7 feet tall when it was standing on its hind legs or running or chasing people on its hind legs, which it seemed to do several times. Long muzzle, fangs, claws, so it wasn't like a Bigfoot. Walked on its toe pads as canines do, so that ruled out bears, people, other things. And some of them had really good looks at it. And when I started checking around town, I found out she wasn't just making this up. There were people talking about it. And I actually, at the time, was working with our county animal control officer on something else. He was investigating puppy mills, and I was kind of interviewing and keeping up with his progress. So there was a real problem with that in the county at that time. That and there were dogs being disposed of, dead ones, in weird ways. So I told him about that, and he said, oh, yeah, people have been writing me. And he pulls this manila file folder out of his desk drawer, and it was labeled werewolf. So whenever a county official has an official file folder, even if it was sort of tongue-in-cheek, as I think it was with him, it's news, you have to find out what's going on there at the very least. So he shared with me the names and contact information of these people that had been writing him, and I started contacting them and going out to interview them, and they did not seem crazy to me. They did not seem like they were trying to hoax or catch attention for themselves. Some of the incidents had happened 3 years even up to almost 10 years earlier. So this was not just something that cropped up and then there were a lot of people going, me too, me too. This was something that had been happening for some years, and people had been pretty much mostly keeping it to themselves, because most people in this society understand that when you come up with saying something that is really beyond the pale for most people to get their heads around or believe, you're just going to get accused of being, crazy or not seeing the right thing or being deceived yourself or whatever. So a lot of people, I still believe there are so many more people who have seen all different types of cryptids but never said anything to anyone, either because they were shot down immediately by their family or they were afraid for their jobs, which is another thing I hear often. And that was the case here too. Well, what happened was I wrote up a story based on their interviews and did kind of a quick sketch. The story ran in the centerfold section of the paper on the weekend of the New Year's, 1991-92. And we just ignited this firestorm of interest and opinion and people coming forward. And the media, even though, remember, this was before things went viral the way they do now. There was no viral type of internet at that time, and people had to actually track me down at the newspaper, either call or write snail mail, and the Milwaukee and Madison TV stations were there, and that brought spots on national syndicates, and then the national shows. I remember Inside Edition came quite early on, back when the host was Bill Riley, Bill O'Reilly, excuse me. So it was just shocking. We did not expect that it was going to get anything other than a couple of weeks of local, publicity. People might have some fun with it, and then it would just kind of die back into the embers. Well, that never happened. The embers have never gone out. It's still something that, going on 26 years later, I still receive reports, sometimes one or two or three a week. It has never stopped, and each time that I write a new book or that a particularly noteworthy incident happens, I get another big spate. There's always a big bump in the sightings reports. And not only that, the past 3 or 4 years, it's been quite different, because for a long time, nobody else was really taking widespread account of these reports and keeping track of them. People in the Bigfoot field were either kind of denying it or saying it must be mistaken or it must be a different breed of Bigfoot that had a muzzle, which, you know, it just, the biological components just don't compare well between great apes and canines. So it's just been in the past few years that all of a sudden this dogman thing has kind of caught on, and there are, you know, radio shows where people can call up and tell their encounters, and people forming dogman organizations and campouts and that kind of thing, which is great. You know, I'm glad to see that it's finally getting some recognition, because it, frankly, it's a very widespread phenomena and runs a lot deeper than I ever thought that it would. And there are many varieties. There's a wide range of places to explore. I think that there's room for all types of storytelling and reporting, investigating, because the final thing is that we don't really know what these creatures or many of the other cryptids like Mothman and Bigfoot really are. They seem to most witnesses to be something different. They are recognized when people see them as something other than your ordinary animal. As smart and talented as bears and wolves and dogs and other known animals are, these things always, even when they don't do anything overtly supernatural, seem off or different to the witnesses. And so there's a lot of room for, you know, for many people to go in and investigate these things in whatever method they think works best for them. I don't think there's one monolithic method that works for everyone. If there were, somebody would have been, you know, rounding up Dogman and Bigfoot and showing them to us by now, and it hasn't happened. There's just a lot of mystery to this field. That and the fact that people keep seeing the things, those are the two things that really keep me hooked in, because I never would have thought I would still be doing this, you know, some 26 years later.
Are there any theories, Linda, as to their origins? And in particular, since Elkhorn, that part of Wisconsin, is your bailiwick, like, do the stories go back to the Native American times? Is there an idea of their origins? Do they, you know, postulate they come from underground or they come from other dimensions? What have the stories over time suggested?
Well, I have interviewed where I've been able to Native Americans, preferably tribal elders. I was able to talk with one Ho-Chunk elder who was also a degreed anthropologist, who was very interested in you know, some of the things I had to say. And what I heard from most of them, and this is not by any means every single Native American, you know, in on these continents, because some of their cultures and beliefs are really quite different from one another. But of the ones I've spoken to personally, they've all said something like, we believe that the Dogman and the Bigfoot are not like your natural animals. They're not wolves. They're not a regular ape. We believe that they were originally spirit creatures who came here and started coming here and know where the doors are or the openings are between our world and their world, and that they can go back when they really need to or really want to. And that's why you don't find bodies. That's why they seem like they can disappear, or you'll see, there are so many reports of footprints going along and then just disappearing. And they believe that that's been going on longer than man has been on the earth, and that they have, there's some sort of a special edict or relationship or historic thing that went down long ago that for the most part makes them leave humans alone, but they have their own places where they want to be, and they can defend that territory. So the thing is that, the other thing is that when they are here, they're not like ghost things usually. They can be completely solid and dense as we are. They will need, in those dense forms, to have energy. That's why so many people see both the Bigfoot and the Dogman running around with some kind of carcass slung over their shoulder or being held in their forelimbs and taken away. They need to eat and have energy, and sightings of little ones have made people think that they probably can breed while they're here. Maybe they can't do that as easily wherever they come from. But whatever, they seem to want to be here, have their own territories, be left alone to do whatever it is they do. And all of the facts of, all of the facets of these Native American culture stories or beliefs about these creatures fit the best with all of the modern contemporary eyewitness observations that I hear. You know, because a lot of times most people will say that it seemed solid, but then you do get these ones where people have observed them either vanishing or the footprints vanish or they seem semi-solid. I've been getting in my latest book, I have a chapter about what people will call shadow creatures because they look like two-dimensional shadows, very, very black and yet alive somehow and aware of them. So there's this degree of opacity in the way that they look and this varying degree of how dense and solid they are where they can be heavy enough to leave huge, deep footprints. You know, that takes weight to do something like that. Or they can seem, to some people, to look like something from the Predator movie where it's almost camouflaged. There's light or heat waves bouncing off of something, but they can't quite make out what it is. You have this whole range. And the best paradigm to explain all of these different observations is the one that these Native American people have shared with me.
That's very interesting because even in the Sasquatch field, Linda, there still seems to be this resistance to reports of the metaphysical, supernatural aspects of Bigfoot. I don't know if there's this feeling where in order to remain credible, they want to, you know, stick to fur samples and footprints and whatnot. But there have been persistent reports going back to the days of the Native Americans that there's this metaphysical, interdimensional aspect to the Sasquatch. And so that seems to be the case with the Dogmen, too.
Yeah, it's actually true. You know, and there's sort of a derogatory term they use in the groups to talk about that aspect. It's called woo, you know, like woo, you know, kind of making fun of the spooky sound. And I think that you're right. I think that a lot of it is they don't want to be disrespected for what they're doing, and they're trying to make it on a purely scientific basis. You know, I think to do that, there are people with doctors. Dr. Jeff Meldrum, for instance, has come forward and spoken a lot about aspects of the footprint casts that have been left behind and showing, you know, why they are from some unique creature and talking about the dermal ridges or patterns that are one way on those and then a different way on humans. And then there have been people who tracked it back to Gigantopithecus as perhaps a direct ancestor that somehow came over on the Bering Strait Bridge and then kind of stayed and adapted to this new world habitat and has just kind of been here and stretched out ever since. His Legend Meets Science, Doug Hychek's of White Wolf's Legend Meets Science talks about that. And Gigantopithecus is a real central thing. And that you know, that sort of research is also really valuable and could be absolutely very useful to many people. But when I did this last book of mine, The Monsters Among Us, what kind of precipitated that was my realizing when I was organizing things for the previous one and looking at things that came out of the one right before that there really were many more of these reports than I used to receive that had seeming associations either with within the creature itself. You know, there was one that was a dog man that two people witnessed that was glowing blue that they had observed coming toward them for a long distance, jumped in the road in front of them, saw it plainly in the headlights, and then watched it running away, or transforming in some way, or seeming so closely associated with a UFO right in the vicinity about the same time, that kind of thing. And I thought, well, you know, if you're really investigating and you're starting with a creature that's unknown, why not go with the unknown sounding reports too, with the reports that I think are dismissed out of hand by a lot of researchers because they just seem like they're impossible. And instead, what I did was, and honestly, the witnesses don't seem any different in terms of their lifestyles, occupations, educations, beliefs, anything like that. The witnesses to both groups seemed identical to me. That's what this book is about. It's about sightings that are associated with various types of phenomena. And where it was possible, where I had a close enough dating to do this, I also went and looked up the phase of the moon, the state of solar flares, whether there were known UFO sightings in the vicinity, or other creature sightings, or there was a history of anything like that, just to see if associations began kind of stacking up, you know, and they kind of did. I mean, it's a very, one book full of these things, you know, is not any sort of final proof, but I did find more often than I expected that there were solar flares, unusual solar flares, when many of these sightings occurred, more so, much more so than full moons. The moon phase seemed to make very little difference, and in fact, the most frequently encountered moon phase was the three quarters, for some reason, rather than the full. I don't know why that is, and it may be purely coincidental. It's not a huge sample to be statistically reliable by any means, but you know, I did it just as sort of a pointer to say, hey, why aren't we looking at all these other possible factors just to see if there are associations, and maybe that will lead us someplace. Who knows?
One of the interesting aspects of some of the other cryptid reports I've heard, and I'm not sure if I'm getting some of the cryptid reports mixed up, because there's, as you know, Linda, there's so many different animals and cryptids out there.
Right.
But some of the reports of the big, hairy, Sasquatch-like beings suggest that even when some of them say are more on the aggressive side and people out of self-defense, fear, or whatever the case may be, fire at them with firearms, sometimes these bullets don't seem to have any effect, outward effect, on these beings. And in other cases we've heard, like the ranch in Utah, the Skinwalker Ranch, so-called, there was these reports of these oversized wolves there, and people reported taking shots at them with no visible effect. It was like, you know, water off a duck's back. And that would suggest that there is some kind of energetic thing going on.
Yeah, it kind of does. And it happens both with the Bigfoot and the Dogman. And I've also heard it in regard to some oversized birds in Iowa and some other places. So it is a phenomena that's not just like a one-off type of thing. It seems to happen repeatedly. I've had people report that to me. And, you know, it's almost like these things are wearing invisible Kevlar vests, you know, or something like that. It's just, even sometimes the creature will go down, but then it gets back up and runs off. And at the most, they might find a tiny smear of blood or something. Not really, usually, though. You'd think that could be a pretty good DNA sample if somebody ever had that. But it's very curious, you know, because if you have a big enough gun, I mean, you can take down a bear or any other animal if you shoot it in the right place. And I've had people tell me they've emptied automatic clips into a creature from a fairly close range, you know, and just nothing. And, you know, again, even if it looks like it could be just a typically flesh and blood sort of creature, it's not behaving like one or responding like one. So you just have to wonder, what is that? You know, are they on just a slightly different wavelength than we are, so that, you know, they can, solidity isn't quite the same thing for them as it is for us? I don't know.
That's a very good point, because although I do, like yourself, see the value of like the rigid scientific method that some cryptozoologists apply to their craft, I do believe it has limitations. And when one kind of sticks to that linear kind of logical mindset, science as we understand it, they're going to run into some problems, because they're going to come across cases such as this, where these beings seem to defy the laws of physics as we understand it. And so these types of factors, you notice straight away that they seem to be a part of this phenomenon. Now, going back to your early days, Linda, What were some of the cases that jumped out at you when you first started getting on the trail of the Dogman? What were some of the early cases that really made you sit up and go, whoa, there's something really to this?
They all were pretty startling to me at the beginning. For instance, there was a group of junior high-aged kids who were out sledding near Bray Road, not on that road, but Bowers Road, actually, nearby there. And they saw what they thought was a big old farm dog just kind of sitting and drinking from, you know, it was one of those days when it was warm enough that the snow was starting to melt, and they were kind of getting the last bit of sledding in there. And they ran over to pet this creature that was sort of licking at him. And all of a sudden, thinking it was a dog, and all of a sudden, the dog stood up.
Oh, wow.
And then kind of paced them. They turned around and ran for the farmhouse. And it, you know, wasn't flat out chasing them. It probably could have caught them, but was more sort of pacing them as if to run them off at the time. And one of those kids was a good friend of one of my sons. And he said, you know, Mom, he wasn't kidding. He wasn't joking. He was really scared. You know, he didn't even hardly want to talk about it. And, you know, my son told, and, you know, kids are like radar on one another. They can detect any kind of a game easily. They know each other too well. And so he believed that. Then there was another woman who was, there was a high school student who was driving out that way, and she was going along. There was a cornfield next to her, and she felt this bump like she ran over something. And she was afraid maybe she hit somebody's pet or whatever, and she stopped the car. She wanted just to see what it was that she hit, and she hears this ka-thump, 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 and here is this bipedal wolf-like creature coming at her at a dead run on its hind legs. And she said she just spun around, stuck herself back in the car, and hit the floor pedal, and zoomed off, but it managed to leap for her car and left scratches on the back of it. And you know, and I went and saw the scratches. You can't guarantee that somebody didn't make those, but they were very consistent with what large claws would leave if they were just kind of, you know, scraping at the last second at the car. So that was pretty scary. And then there was, kind of going up the age levels here, there was a woman in her late 20s who was who worked at kind of a cafe and bar in downtown Elkhorn, and lived, she had to drive down Bray Road to go home. And she's driving along, and she sees this big thing sitting on the side of the road that she said looked like, you know, she said if there ever was such a thing as a werewolf, this would have been it. And she thought it looked evil. It stuck her that way. It was holding some kind of a chunk of what looked like a piece of raccoon or some kind of, you know, hairy roadkill, chewing on it, and it was kneeling, you know, in a way that looked just really strange to her, like a canine shouldn't be able to do. It had these big teeth. And that frightened her quite a bit. And when she went to the library to look up for some kind of canine, the only thing that she could find that looked like that was, there used to be these golden books of the paranormal and the occult, and she looked up werewolves in one. It had the set of those golden books at the Elkhorn Library, and she looked that up and found it, and was positive that that was what she saw. And all of these people were reporting this to the animal control officer at the time. Then there was a farm wife who was driving her small car along one of the paths in a cornfield to take food to her husband, who was out working on harvesting, and it just crossed this little, you know, tractor lane right in front of her. And she said she just sat and watched it in amazement. Maybe because she was in the car and it was daylight, she said she wasn't really afraid of it because it wasn't trying to attack her. It was just more like, yeah, I can let you see me. Here I go, you know, that kind of thing. And just kept walking in the direction that it was going. There was a farmer out there, Mike Otten, who was probably one of the very few that admitted they'd been drinking before they saw this thing. But you know, he said it absolutely wasn't a factor. And really, when you think of it, I don't know if you've ever drank any amount of alcohol or know anybody who has. I'm being a little facetious there. But who do you know that has drank alcohol and been drunk and then seen a strange animal?
Yes. It's a depressant anyway. It doesn't have that effect.
Yeah, you end up, you know, falling asleep at the wheel or, you know, passing out if you drink too much. But you know, you don't really start seeing strange things and hallucinations unless you're so far gone that you're having the DTs.
Yeah.
This guy said to me, he said, I sobered up really fast when I saw that thing, you know, because he was just sort of shocked out of it. So you have that. Then there was an elderly lady who, well, when I say elderly, she was in her 60s at the time, which isn't really elderly anymore at all. And she was coming home from a late factory shift when she saw another sighting very similar to these along the side of the road walking. You know, I could go on and on. There were lots. Some that never had their stories really told because they didn't want to. There was a young woman, I know her family quite well, and she was up in a tree when one of these things ran out of the woods, just sort of treed her. You know, she was kind of kicking at it. It didn't come up the tree. People have said they think that they can climb. More often they will bound and or leap at something, and she'd gotten up as high as she could and had to wait like an hour before it finally left, and then waited again till she was sure it was gone. Finally ran into the farmhouse. So, I mean, I could keep on telling these stories.
I get the gist of it. Now, in some of the Sasquatch lore, there seems to be this telepathic element, or an element where sometimes a Sasquatch can appear in the dreams of people and, you know, have an interaction with them. Has there ever been any similar report of a dogman, an upright canine, that seemed to have a telepathic linkage to somebody or seemed to be able to show up in someone's dreams?
Oh, yeah, I've heard that, definitely, from various witnesses. Sometimes it occurs in cases where people live in a place that's being sort of habitually visited, usually by just one animal. And they'll feel that it's looking in the windows, that it's sort of focusing on them in some ways. Sometimes they'll end up getting their house exercised or cleansed by, you know, the religious practitioner, whatever that is. There does seem to be that element. And then there's also this strange element with the dog man that people are really reluctant to call it telepathy. But it's sort of like, it's almost more like an empathy. What they will say is, you know, and usually it's after they've told me the whole thing, and then they're quiet for a second, and they say, you know, there's one more thing. I hate to tell you because you're going to really think I'm crazy. But when it was looking at me, I felt like it was somehow telling me, and then there's this sort of variety of messages. It's usually something like, it was telling me that it could come and get me if it wanted to, or if I told anyone that it would come and get me, or that it could jump in my car if it wanted to. Probably the most common one is that it was trying to get across to me that it was superior to me, you know, that it was smarter and better and superior and, you know, that sort of thing. And that freaks people out a lot. And that's what really seems to haunt people. When they have that experience, it's very hard for them to forget that feeling of being sort of owned by this unknown creature. You know, it's just really startling. And they'll say that every single day they think of it and remember it and think, why me? Why did I have to see that? And oftentimes, many people wish that they had not seen it because it can disturb lives. And, you know, and I'm not talking about people who are already troubled. I mean, just people who are going along, you know, jobs, families, and this thing hits them. And it sort of shakes their world. They realize there are things they haven't been told about or that most people don't believe in that really are there in some sort of way that, you know, as you said before, our present science doesn't understand at this time.
You mentioned a moment ago, Linda, that in at least one of the cases you investigated, there was a UFO in the nearby vicinity. That's something that comes up once in a while in the Sasquatch lore, where an eyewitness or witnesses would describe a Sasquatch in close proximity to like a hovering UFO or to a landed UFO. Back in the early 1970s, I had this horrifying dream of a gleaming silver saucer landing in the very busy avenue in front of my house in San Jose, California, a ramp descending, yep, and then three very large Sasquatch-type beings coming out of it, making this god-awful screaming noise that just terrifies me to this day. So there seems to be that kind of linkage between the Sasquatch on the one hand and this ET UFO aspect. Could you elaborate a bit on the Dogman cases that you're aware of that has that aspect to it?
Well, I think that, you know, they may be slightly more vague than that, but a couple of them come to mind, one that's older and one that's not so old. The older one happened, 15 years ago, maybe more. I can't remember exactly. This was a Wisconsin case. It was kind of near the middle of the state in the Little Old Plain River area where there were lots of marshes and lakes and rural homes. And this young man wrote me that, well, actually, he was a young man when it happened. He was probably a little older than that when he actually wrote me. But he said that he and his mother had a couple of times seen these silver disc-shaped UFOs right over their neighborhood, very close, and had very good sightings. And a neighbor had also seen the same thing. And not too long after that happened, he was out kind of just having sort of a bond, not a drinking sort of event, but with some of his guy friends, they were out having a campfire and just sitting around it, you know, and chatting. And they started hearing noises, and they finally saw this thing that looked like sort of a muscular yet starved, skinny canine, missing a little bit of hair, but too large to be just a dog or a wolf, and on its hind legs and observing them and kind of tracking them around when they tried to leave. And he saw this thing several times, you know, before it finally went away. But it was the feeling, one of the times that he observed the UFO, he said from its actions, he had the feeling that it was dropping something off.
Mm.
You know, coming low, waiting a minute, and then sailing off. And so he's always had to wonder, you know, if there was this connection. Then there was, and sometimes people don't see the craft, but they'll see really strange light phenomena. I don't know if you get the Paranormal Witness TV show there, but there was an episode that was taken from my book, Real Wolfmen. I called it the Maine Wolf Pack. This happened in Maine, you know, up in the eastern seaboard of the U.S. Just a few years ago. And this woman, Shelley Martin, and her husband were sitting out on the porch of this lovely old farmhouse that they had rented. They had a pond, and deer would often come to drink from that pond. And they kept a big flashlight so that when the deer were there, they could kind of, you know, shine it on them and see what they were doing. They were drinking coffee. And all of a sudden, they both had this feeling that something was really wrong. And the husband picked up the flashlight and shined it. And there were five upright, wolf-like creatures, two on one side, three on the other, that were advancing upon them.
Whoa.
They were flanking them. I mean, they had divvied up and were coming from two different sides, which is actually a behavior that wolves will partake in. You know, wolves can be very strategic in their hunting. They're extremely intelligent, more than people realize. But these were not just wolves. These were things walking on their hind legs. And they knew they were at least 7 feet tall because they passed under this, or past this shed roof or door. I think it was a door, actually. That was that tall, and their heads were level with it when they went past it. So they backed into the house and called 911, which, of course, didn't want to bother with it, and told them to call, you know, the animal control or the local DNR or whatever. They just told them to go in the house, stay in the house, lock the doors and windows, and then, you know, wait until morning to come out. And so they did that, having no choice. The guns they owned were all locked up outside of the house, so they didn't have access, anything like that. And the things stayed out there until morning, and they would go up in the upstairs, look out the upstairs bedroom windows and look down below and see these pairs of yellow eyes peering back up at them. So, you know, it was very strange. And then the paranormal witness did a pretty good job of portraying that. They embellished and exaggerated some things. One of the things that they exaggerated a little bit was that before this happened, the Rockwells had noticed some strange light phenomena in an orchard adjacent to their property and nearby. And the husband had been out to investigate it once or twice, but they hadn't really found too much out there. And a little more was made of that in the TV version than was represented to me when I interviewed them. The other weird thing about that incident is that nobody's ever been able to get the copy of that 911 call. I tried, got absolutely nowhere. I was calling all sorts of, they'd say, well, no, call here, call there, and got nowhere. So I asked the Rockwells to try it because they live right there. It's their own community. They were told that the 911 call had just been made into a transcript, which is not the same thing as having the call because you can change it however you want. But the transcript had been lost. Now, you know, that's not supposed to happen. Those calls are public and they're supposed to be made available. But they weren't able to. And then the paranormal witness team also tried to get it. None of us had any luck getting the recording of that 911 call.
Well, that's interesting. Not surprising that they'd want to kind of flush something like that from the public record. In the time we have left in what's been a fascinating first half, Linda, in the Sasquatch lore, we sometimes hear stories of, let's say, like a deep black military interest. I mean, we know that on occasion, well, you've been talking about how animal control officers, you know, are given reports of all these various cryptids at times, including Dogman. And we know that once in a while, a law enforcement officer, because they're out doing their patrols in remote places, sometimes see unusual things. Does it seem to you that there has been an interest or knowledge at some level of the deep black military intelligence community about the Dogman? Because I've got a story about that, too, from my particular field.
Sure, and I'd love to hear your story, too. And I do, it seems like I hear from more and more people who have high security clearances here or there, they're state patrolmen, you know, or other military, whatever, and they find these things out and they're frustrated because if they try reporting it to their superiors, they're just shut down, shut out, sometimes fired. I've become friends with a state, not patrolman, but a state sheriff's, excuse me, a county sheriff's deputy from a different county than I live in. Between he and his wife, who is also a sheriff's deputy, have seen 4 or 5 different dogmen, kind of depending on how you arrange the sightings. And most of them were while on duty, just doing the late shift patrol. And they could not, they were very frustrated because they could not go up line with these and tell anybody about it. It was just, you know, if somebody calls you about that, sure, tell them that you went there and you didn't see anything. But as for you seeing it, you know, we don't want to hear that. So, yeah, I have seen that, definitely.
Well, what we've seen, my colleagues and I, in the alien abduction UFO field, we have a phrase, a term we use, you know, DNA is the currency of the universe, because within certain DNA profiles, there is this latent metaphysical capability. And the military and these other deep black weird science organizations, they like to get a hold of unusual DNA, let's say, and whether it's tracking a certain human family tree or obtaining DNA from some of these cryptids, it seems that elements of the deep black military, small sample size to be sure, Linda, and I, you know, if there's listeners out there that have information about this, I'd like to hear it, but we have people in our field we call my labs. They're alien abductees who on occasion, sometimes quite frequently, are kidnapped, trained, debriefed, mind-controlled by deep black elements of the military. And I know two gals personally that not only have they had ET encounters, not only have they been messed with on various occasions by the military, but they've had encounters with what amounts to wolfmen, the wolfmen that seem to be working for the military. And one of them spoke in English and threatened a friend of mine about talking about her experiences. Another friend of mine was taken into a mountain, into what amounts to an underground base, by one of these wolfmen. And on another occasion, a veteran UFO researcher in Southern California, Bill Hamilton, told me a story that was related to him by a family. They were driving near the base of Tehachapi Mountain, which is notorious. Within the Tehachapi Mountain, there's a large aerospace underground base. And this family got lost, basically. They were just driving around trying to find their way, and they came across what they described as like a platoon of these wolfmen in Air Force uniforms, and they were being drilled by what seemed to be an Air Force officer. And when they saw this spectacle, they immediately freaked out. The father turned the car around and tried to get out of there. Meanwhile, all these wolfmen set upon them and started throwing rocks and stones and sticks at them and whatnot, and, you know, the family got away. But they couldn't wrap their mind around the fact that they'd seen what seemed to be wolfmen, but in a military context. So I just thought I'd throw it out there because, you know, these deep black military agencies, they seem to have an interest, an abiding interest in these cryptids. We've heard stories about them sending teams out to track down, like, rogue Bigfoot that are attacking people, or in other contexts, you know, a more of an alien context, there seems to be some conflict at some level between certain elements of the military and these different ET groups. So, yeah, I just thought I'd mention that, Linda.
Yeah, and I've had reports like that, too. I had some people report being out in southwestern desert somewhere. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't remember exactly. And seeing this Jeep go by with, at first, what looked like, you know, four just ordinary soldiers sitting up. They could kind of see the camo uniforms and everything and the hats. And it got closer, and they all had dog heads.
Yeah, those stories I just related were from the desert southwest, Linda. One in the Phoenix area, and probably in the mountains to the north of it, and the other in the high desert of Southern California, the Tehachapi Mountains there.
That seems to be where those things are going on, if they are, at least where the reports are coming from. You know,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And the thing that strikes me is that these are something different than those fully canine-looking creatures that people are seeing along the ditches and roads, where they have perfectly formed dog legs and forelimbs.
Yes.
These have shoulder. Canines don't have shoulders. If you think about it, there's no way that a completely canine could throw a rock or a stick at you because they don't have rotator cuffs.
Yes,
and
or
they
wear
don't
a shirt, yes.
They don't have grasping. They may have long, elongated paws. That is one difference that many people notice about these dogmen, is they'll say the paws seemed elongated, but they still don't have the opposable thumb, you know, the grasping thing, when they're the regular canines. And so, you know, you've got this thing about, you know, throwing things. They'll have shoulders, which, again, canines don't have shoulders because their muscles and tissue are arranged to blunt the impact of the forelimbs hitting the ground all the time. And so they're not, you know, in humans and apes, it's called brachiating shoulders, meaning we're meant to kind of spread them out and maybe, you know, hang in a tree or something, which would be really, really difficult for a regular canine. But when you get these stories that are sort of paramilitary, and I have noticed a correlation, by the way, between all types of canine sightings and military installations, that seems to be an attractive place for them to be.
Yes, that's a very good distinction, Linda, because perhaps I'm just guessing here that there may be some hybridization at work to make some of these military, you know, wolfmen more humanoid in appearance. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment, Linda. For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell them how they can get a hold of you if they have any sightings or want to report anything to you?
Sure. The easiest way is just to go to lindagodfrey.com, and there is a page that has books and bio information, and you'll find a form there, or you can just email me. You can find the email at that place, too. And again, it's lindagodfrey.com, and there are also, it's my blog, you'll find stories that haven't made it into the books in many cases, or that supplement some of the books. It's sort of enlightening. And just what I'm up to, places I'm going to be appearing, recent podcasts, that sort of thing.
Well, we've reached the end of the first segment. You've been listening to our very special guest, Linda Godfrey, talk about the upright canines and the dogmen and other aspects of cryptozoology. You're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.